fighter. If you've got to fight, fight dirty.
Damn, look like my women is on time.
Babe, I could show warm you up.
No shit, baby.
I can dig it.
They called her One Eye, then ran for their lives. We've got a peck of trouble. Come on, let's get in character.
Here we go.
On the map of human experience, pain has always been the compass rose, the symbol that points to true north.
Hello, you bastards. Welcome to the Daily Grindhouse Podcast. This is Joe, a.k.a. The Creeper, coming at you from dailygrindhouse.com. To my internet left is Dr. Freeman Williams, a.k.a. Dr. Freaks, actor, writer, purveyor of fine taste, and owner of the sweetest can in Texas. How you doing, Dr. Freaks?
I'm doing fine. Stay away from my can.
All right. And our very special guest this evening is Mike White, editor and writer of Cashiers du Cinema, number one Conrad Bain fan, and the voice and brain behind the projection booth. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing so good, thank you.
That's great. And last but certainly not least, we have the writer and director of the movie we're talking about this evening, Lethal Force, Sir Alvin E. Karma, philanthropist, humanitarian, and Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band apologist. How you doing, sir?
Don't you forget that, baby. I'm all about the Frampton, man. I'm all about the Frampton. Sandy Farina forever.
But the film, of course, we're talking about this evening is Lethal Force.
The name is Savage. And lady, I'm mad, bad, and dangerous to know.
I'm assuming all three of you have, at some point, seen this film.
Several times. Yes.
For those of you not in the know, it's probably like four of you, the summary in a nutshell goes as such. After his wife is killed and his child kidnapped, a hitman by the name of Jack is forced to try to capture and or kill Savage, his friend and fellow assassin. Despite having a plethora of masked goons at his disposal, Jack finds the mission very difficult to complete, since it just so turns out that Savage is tougher than Clint Eastwood and more durable than Rasputin. Did I miss anything there?
That's about right.
Oh, see, I thought we were talking about the 2002 film called Cottonmouth, a.k.a. Lethal Force. Yeah.
You know, I was going to ask you about that. Did you have to get into a little fisticuffs with the writer and director of Cottonmouth?
Well, you know, it turns out that was Roger Corman's name change and not theirs. So the Cottonmouth had two titles. It was Cottonmouth originally, then it got turned to Silent Trigger, and then when Roger Corman picked it up, he turned it into Lethal Force. So, you know, whatever. It's another sad footnote in the history of a fine filmmaker, you know.
I'm sorry, Roger Corman. Can anyone...
No. You need help on that? You're not familiar with his work?
Yeah. It just goes to show how firmly Sir Alvin had his finger on the pulse of pop culture.
Exactly.
That's right.
You know that. You know, if Roger Corman scoops him, you know, dude, you're there. You were there in the moment.
But hey, which Lethal Force won out in the end? Which one do we all remember? Which Lethal Force are we talking about right now? So fuck you, Roger Corman.
That's right. I love you, Richard Tyson and Robert Vaughn. You guys are the best.
At any rate, I'll throw in my 2 cents first. I, for one, completely dig Lethal Force. If I'm not mistaken, it was made for $12,000.
Maybe 12 and 15. Maybe it was something that, you know, it was piecemeal budget, you know, put together. At the end of the day, maybe like 15 to 16. Like at the end of the day.
But well, like, if it was made for $12,000, I really love it. If it was 15 or 16, I'm kind of growing cold on it now.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, it was made for $5.
But I completely love this movie. I mean, I remember when I got it. Gosh, it was 6 years ago, and I threw it in, and I would get screeners here and there, and mostly they were just horrible. But occasionally you could just sit back and go, you know, with the budget they have and the resources they have, I could see where they're coming from. But Lethal Force, just budget aside, I mean, the movie just rocks. Okay. I mean, it has everything you could possibly want. You want gunplay, you got it. You want martial arts, there it is. You want burly, fez-sporting lesbians, it has that too.
Every demo. Every demo.
And I think the one thing I really do dig about it is that you can tell that the movie was made by someone who not only knows cinema, but loves it. I mean, I think heart and soul is just poured into the celluloid that makes Lethal Force. And the affection just shows, the passion for the medium, from all the homages to the tight editing to the choreography to Frank Pather's acting, of course.
Awesome, yes.
I mean, you could just tell this was a labor of love. And it worked. I mean, everything works in this film for me. Freeman, what did you hate about it?
I hated it. It took me so long to see it. I think I remember back around the time you were probably schlepping it around the film festival circuit. I think it was Keith Allison over at Teleport City was raving about it.
Oh, yeah.
And I kept thinking, man, you know, I got to see this. This sounds great. And, of course, you know, time passed. I got old. I completely forgot about it. When Joe starts saying, okay, we're doing Lethal Force. Well, okay, Lethal Force. Yeah, okay. Okay, I can get that at Amazon for $4. Cool. And then I had it in my hands, and I went, oh, my God, this is that movie. And I put it in the player, and I'm, as usual, sitting there with my arms crossed going, okay, movie, show me what you got. And I see this credit, you know, starring Cash Flagg Jr.
Yeah.
And at that point, I relax because I go, okay, I'm in good hands. It just continued sweeping me along after that. You know, like Joe, I am totally impressed. I loved it. When we got to the first John Woo bromance moment with the harmonica music, I'm like, oh, we're not going there. Yes, we're going there. Oh, wow.
And then we go there again later.
Uh-huh. Yeah. The affection for the John Woo gunplay stuff was evident. Loved the kung fu scenes. Always loved well-done kung fu. I want to know where I can get a fez that big. That fez looked like it might be able to fit my enormous head.
The wheelchair guy, that was his fez, actually, turns out.
Oh, was he a Mason?
Weird side note, like, he was a Marine liaison during the Iraqi occupation and stuff. He was like a translator, diplomat, attaché. He was like, he's like fluent in like Farsi and all that stuff. He's like an expert go-to guy during that time for the military. For you know, just all things Middle Eastern. That was like his day job, being a consultant. And there in Iraq, you know, the 2003, right after all that shit went down, hanging about Baghdad, you know, in a flak jacket, you know, with the kebab guys. I guess in between mortar rounds, I guess.
Wow,
that's amazing. And so would you go to say that his job was communication and talking?
One of those dudes you go to. It's like, you know, like to prevent cultural misunderstandings.
Oh, no. What I was going was, here he is with his very prestigious occupation of communication, and then, if I'm not mistaken, his dialogue is completely dubbed.
Oh, yeah, that. Oh, yeah, because he's a... he's a good... Yeah, well, that's actually more. Yeah, well, yeah, I guess he wasn't a very good actor. I mean, his delivery was kind of not so great, but we pulled a Shikun thing on him, like Man of the Dragon, and we got a guy who was a really good voiceover guy. And like, you know, put on some sunglasses, and suddenly it turns into performance. And you know, all it took was got five factors in a costume and a wheelchair, and boom, you know, it's like he's instantly villainous.
What's this about, Mal?
Rita, why did you kill the guard? And in such a horrible way.
He was out of line.
So were you. Please, remind me why I keep you around. Now.
Pito pito sangrito, dak pan puro maldito. Pito pito sangrito, dak pan puro maldito.
Come here, baby.
call for you.
Well, before we get into the details, Mr. White, what are your thoughts on this film, Lethal Force?
Oh, geez. I mean, I've been a fan of this since the first time I saw it. I don't remember when the first time I saw this thing was, Alvin. I mean, it had to be like, you showed a rough print of it or a rough cut of it years and years ago at MicroCineFest, and just as soon as it started to unspool, I was like, this is the movie for me. I mean, just it just hit me on all the right channels, you know, the action, the comedy, everything, you know, the geysers of blood. I love the way that it's shot, the way that it's cut. So, yeah, it's just, I really can't say enough nice things about this film. It's one of those that I try to champion and let folks know about whenever I possibly can. And it's not one that I tire of ever. I mean, they showed it up here a few years ago. There was some sort of goofy film festival thing going on in Michigan here, and rounded up as many of my coworkers as I possibly could. So all three of us went over there and caught it. And yeah, it was, they were as impressed as I was the first time I saw it. It was just really nice.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, it's just a great movie. That's why I was a little worried, because I owned the VHS that Sir Al actually sent to me oh so many years ago. And I love the film, but usually my hands are so full that I don't have time to rewatch movies, let alone watch movies I want to watch. And when I advocated Lethal Force for this podcast, hyping it up to everyone, to Freeman and to G at Daily Grindhouse, I remember actually putting the tape in after selling it so hard and thinking, man, I haven't watched this in a while. I hope it doesn't suck. And then about 10 minutes in, I'm like, oh, yeah, this movie does fucking rock. Okay, good. I made a good choice.
Yeah, you did.
What's the story behind Lethal Force? Were you just sitting on the pot one day and then just this brilliant film came to you? Or did the heavens part and a beam of light shine down on your forehead? What's the story behind the film?
No, well, the story is, I mean, nothing terribly super dramatic. It was just after getting out of film school, you know, I was sort of hustling around for a couple of years with screenplays and short films. Yeah, eventually, you know, they ran out of their freshest date. And so, yeah, I needed a new project to sort of like tool around. And I wanted to make a movie. You know, I've been sort of sitting on my ass and just sort of like thinking and planning. And I wrote a couple of screenplays that, you know, basically I could produce, or just sort of like overly ambitious. I couldn't possibly produce, but, you know, just something in the back of my head. After working the screenplays every which way and the short films every which way, I decided, you know, it's time to make a movie. And so I decided to make a movie that had a flexible concept, and could be done on live either. Worst case scenario, I could do most of it myself, and best case scenario, I can get an actual sort of a crew together, and just having it be sort of not too keyed in or tied into sort of having a giant budget or giant resources. And so I knocked out the script, which was a really short, really tight script. It was set within a 72-hour period. And basically, if you set a script or any story within a very short time span, theoretically, more often than not, you come up with a screenplay that's very tight, without a lot of fat. And so I ended up with a screenplay that was like 70-some-odd pages. And then, you know, just went around shaking the tree, using a lot of research I'd done. In the meantime, I'd been like trolling around the back of Shock Cinema, people who are in the area filmmakers. I think if I found the effects guy from like a back issue of like Monster Makeup Journal. So I think that from like way back. I mean, like there's a guy who was like I called him like straight up out of the blue, just saying, "Hello, are you the guy who slings latex?" And he said, "Yes, yes, I am." Okay, awesome, thank God. And then like so the action the camera guy and the action guy, he was the guy from Eric Thornett. He was from the back of Shock Cinema. Because he's like basically a stone's throw away, maybe like 20 minutes from where I am. He had a nice write up in Shock Cinema, so I call him up. And then the producer guy, or just the everybody else guy, a fella I met Johns Hopkins Film Society. You know, so with just having that core group, it was enough of a functioning crew that we could go ahead, and then we just did the whole casting thing, casting around local actors. I had myself as one of the actors, just in case, just to make sure that there was always at least one person could be left standing if things went really, really, really bad. But you know, we were able to put people together, and when what we had was able to either compensate switch around the script so we could work with what we had, or we were able to find a couple of people who are actually, or a good bunch of people actually, when I look back on it, who are actually good for the roles and are well cast. So it all sort of meshed together just because of the, like I said, the concept was sort of a, like I said, it's a homage, it's sort of a cheese factor built into it, and it was, I was able to sort of dial it up or dial it down, or eventually dialing it up once I got the dailies back, and I just sort of working that into the production, turning a negative into a plus.
Speaking of everything sort of meshing together, you really took advantage of shooting in Maryland and the surrounding areas when there's so much history and just natural backgrounds you can just use for free, I'm assuming, around the D.C. area. The scene coming particular to mind is the Jack's meeting with Savage next to the Awakening statue, which I found particularly inspired. Did you scout any of these locations? Did you have any other locations, famous locations in mind you considered shooting in? How did that come to pass?
I think we had, there were like two basic locations which we had to do a bit of research to get permission. One was the Awakenings, and then one was the Fort Washington, the Civil War fort in Fort Washington, Maryland. So basically, I just sent a nice letter to the park people saying X, Y, and Z. You know, we're student film. Can we shoot here? They said, oh yeah, sure, whatever. Just like, you know, just we just couldn't like sort of like rope it off and just keep people out. We decided we would have to work within whatever public showed up during those days. So basically, whatever the Awakenings was that, you know, we would be shooting for like five, 10 minutes, then we have to stop, and then like people will come by, you know, jump around on the giant, jump into his mouth, jump into his palm, you know, make those pictures, and then leave, and then we shoot 10 more minutes, and you know, we got all of that knocked out in 3 hours. So it wasn't a big deal. And then for Washington, when was just strictly, we were just there for like 2 days, just for a weekend, and like in the middle of some bizarre, they were doing like a reenactment that wasn't just Civil War. It was Civil War, and then like Roman, and then World War I. And I don't know how that worked exactly, but you know, we just worked around that.
Was that simultaneous?
Pretty much, they were all on the same day. It was just like every reenactor they had in the area, just for some reason, converging upon Fort Washington, Maryland for that weekend. As a big demo for here, you know, here I am, my Roman gladius, ha-ha, be my leather skirt, hooray!
The World War I soldiers and the Romans weren't mixing it up, or you didn't get a crossover going on?
That was like a really, it was like a really bad Doctor Who episode. But, Yeah, awesome. You know, it was whatever. They shot off cannons. That was pretty cool. And everyone, like, generally, most of the cast weren't aware of the place to begin with. So it was like in between, you know, it was taking breaks. Like, hey, this is a cool, awesome place. You know, I mean, it's the way I found it. So, you know, old timey fort. You know, those places are always interesting.
Now, speaking of interesting, all your villains were very colorful, from their matching outfits and masks, sort of a Foot Clan meets the Baseball Furies. And it was also ingenious in the fact that the majority of your characters, at least the henchmen, are wearing white masks. So you pretty much could put anyone behind a mask if you needed an extra villain for a particular scene. But how did that come to pass, where you had so many colorful villains with big afros, with white masks, with fezes, and doing a seductive drill dance?
The mask thing was always there. Looking back at the drafts, it was something that was written to the script. Just, I mean, a bolt out of the blue, really just inspiration. But I think the look came from Eyes Without a Face guy, the George
Billy
Pratt
Idol.
Yes, that guy. Billy Idol, yes. Anyway, you shut up. I'm making a point here about film. Film and stuff. You boy, you go down there, go watch your karate. I'm making a film. There was a George Franju. He did Eyes Without a Face, or Les Yeux Sans Visage. He did a film with Gretchen Corbett. Called a Fantomas type thing, and there were guys with masks, and that's where I took the cue from, look-wise. So that was always in there, because I knew wrangling people would become an issue with if you had a really big cast. And anyway, in the area, there aren't a lot of, like, freaky Michael Berryman, you know, scraggly mafia types, you know, in the DMV. It's just a very sort of white bread area. So I know I didn't want to make my things any more difficult than they had to be, and so that was always there. And then
you should have gone to Glen Burnie for those kind of folks.
Oh, yeah. Silver Spring is a rough place, you know. You're the AFI and the CBS, Discovery Channel. Holy shit. It's a circle of fire, my friend. Go ahead.
Now, what was the name of the villain, just all in black with the red bow tie?
Psycho Bowtie.
Oh, yeah. Qu'est-ce que c'est? Yeah.
Qu'est-ce que c'est? Eric's character's name. It's like, okay, whatever. You know, it's like a... we actually name him in the movie, so that's just the credits and everything. Otherwise, it would have been a Casanova Wong or Steve. I voted for Steve, but you know, it's like whatever. Okay, fine. Your psycho bow tie make you happy. Okay, great. Whatever. So,
Freeman, did you think he was channeling a little bit of Ken Lo from Drunken Master 2 with the whole twitchy leg kung fu?
Yeah, I was too busy going, oh shit, yeah. to critique much of anything at that point.
You were too distracted by the Pee Wee Herman red boomerang bow tie.
I kept waiting for him to use that. But no, we're talking about the goons, that motif just, it was one of the best subtle gags in it, I guess. And, you know, if it wasn't a subtle gag, you know, my apology, take credit for it. Is they've got that one long extended fight scene where Savage is always going up against three of the goons at once. You know, he takes out three of the goons and another three rush up, and then he's got that long moment where they've got the stare between Savage and the Prather character, and then three more guys show up, and it's so obviously the same three guys.
Yeah.
God, I loved it.
It's like, you know, it's a point being like maybe a clever lampshade hanging of a very obvious conceit here, because let's you know, the audience isn't retarded. They know at some point that we have maybe at most five goons. That's it, and so. You know, we're going to acknowledge this bit, a little bit of absurdity when we get right down to it. So
yeah, I think it's why Lethal Force works so well for me more than earlier before we started recording the program. Major, we were talking about, you know, crap movies like Meet the Spartans and stuff like that. The airplane style movies just don't work for me. Lethal Force, you know, it's like a Blamar with Lost Skeleton of Cadavera. To do a good parody of the genre, you have to make the genre movie. You can't just sit back and throw rocks at it. And this is what Lethal Force is. It's an awesome action film on its own. And the fact that if you're in the groove with it, you're catching all this stuff and going, yeah, it's awesome.
Every once in a while, I think it kind of dips its toe into almost airplane-esque comedy, especially the scene that comes to mind, which happens to be one of my favorite scenes, is when after Savage falls off the parking garage and wanders into the church and has that discussion with Jesus about cookies. That crosses the line as far as the more subtle humor that I think is laid throughout the film, but it works. Yeah, but I was dying.
It works because it works because it's been not really subtle, but because it's been serious about its approach up to that point. And you could take those liberties at that point because you weren't doing, you know, a goofy ass movie.
I like that there are just such spectacular action scenes, and then you get the moments like the African gentleman that kidnapped the guys, and you know, it's like, where are you guys from? Oh, Wisconsin. Okay, you know,
yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
And then they have that great line about, no, they said they're from Minnesota, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And he goes, and obviously they start speaking this other language altogether, and then, spoiler alert, Savage kills them, and he goes, those guys weren't from Minnesota, they were from Wisconsin.
I think it's the other way around, and I can say
was
that
it?
Because I just saw the movie yesterday. We're from Wisconsin, you want some cheese? Blah, 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 blah. Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Cheeseheads, that's correct.
But yeah, they're obviously speaking some bizarre made-up language. Those guys weren't from Wisconsin, they were from Minnesota.
This is just a hunch, but they weren't from Wisconsin. From their dialect, I could tell that they were, in fact, from Minnesota. And people from Minnesota are easily the most ruthless, bloodthirsty killers you'll ever meet. Never heard that one. You've never been to Minnesota.
I think it actually was Kenyan, actually. I think it was the actual, like, for real language, and then it was badly phonetically spoken, you know, by all the actors. You know, originally it was they had a long fight scene, but then we shot it and it was horrible. And so we got... the psycho bow tie thing was the fill in for that bit. So I had to write something really quickly to compensate for this switch over to the new guy. So he said, okay, well, blah 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 blah. You know, and these things. I mean, I have no beef with people in Minnesota or Wisconsin or any Midwestern country or state. Or it was just something that, you know, you sit down, hits you in the head, and it's like, this is what I'm going to write. And in your face, you know, Wisconsin or Minnesota or fine Midwestern people, I don't know.
Well, the fight choreography was so impressive, and considering it was such a low-budget film, I mean, with a lot of the low-budget action films I've seen, whenever they try to go into the whole fisticuffs, it's usually just bad to the point of embarrassment.
Mm-hmm.
And even in this film, I mean, in this film, it was just great stuff. Even Psycho Bowtie, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, but watching that film, it feels like Cash Flagg actually does know martial arts, and Psycho Bowtie is kind of the benefactor from some solid editing.
Mr. Flagg Jr. is just very physically fit and flexible and coordinated. That's like, he can do the splits and he can do a good spin kick. And credit where credit is due, Psycho Bowtie or Eric Thornett, the actual fellow's name, he basically really had a sort of a prime, very sort of had a really great eye, very sharp. Really is like he was like really cranking out at that period a lot of like a stunt and fight oriented type movies. On his own, and I was able to bring him in sort of like a really good, at a good sweet spot. And so when he came in, he was able to had this being able to razor sharp with the choreography, because I basically it was done very much in a Hong Kong style of just cutting for the edit, you know, just shoot and just get that one shot of the punch and one shot of this and one shot of that, instead of doing the whole kind of like old-timey or the Buffy the Vampire Slayer type, you know, really super wide shot of fighting, then a tight close up, and a super wide and tight close up. Was very sort of dynamic. Like the whole being cutting so close to the bone gives it a dynamicism that you usually see. And so basically, you know, he was really on his game, top form when he was doing Lethal Force. So it's like I said, he did a hell of a job.
So
there are so many cuts in this film. I'm actually playing it back as we're talking right now and just watching the scene with Psycho Bowtie when he's being set on fire and all this. Just, I mean, there were so many shots in here that are just a few seconds long, but you're just telling the story so well through the editing. It's great.
I ran into the Telecine guy at the local the film lab place who did the film transfer, and he was impressed by like it's like, hey man, you didn't even shoot slates. You just shot what you needed, and boom, you had a movie. Yes, you mean like if you're not shooting sound, and if you're basically the editor, there's no reason to waste the film on slates. Just go hit the trigger and just start filming, because there's no point in wasting those 5 seconds of just like, you know, scene one, take two, click. You know, it's like, who cares? Just go for it. You know. So.
Wow.
What do you think about action films nowadays that are edited to the point of incoherency?
They all suck and they're horrible and they make me sad.
Every single one of them sucks.
Not only are they edited, over-edited, but it's all like those macro close-ups that are just like, did a still frame of it. You couldn't even tell what was going on in the frame.
Well, the first time I really noticed that was in like the Bourne movies, and I was just assuming it was because Matt Damon doesn't know martial arts from a hole in the ground. So maybe I'm mistaken, but
Bourne. I'm sorry, Alvin. I think the first Bourne was done very well. I think the second one though is when they just went nuts with that Confuso vision, because there were so many times where I'm like, what is happening? Who is doing what? Why is the camera shaking? I feel like I'm going to throw up.
It's hard to pinpoint exactly where I got all shaky cam. I know at least with Saving Private Ryan, that was a flashpoint. But then it didn't get really incoherent until maybe the last like 5 years, where it was just like, you know, let's fuck with the shutter. Let's be that weird choppy kind of thing, and then like make it barely coherent. I think Saving Private Ryan, and then maybe like 20 Days Later, because that really had not in a bad way, but they really had that kind of a flickery kind of thing. Between those two, somehow it got absorbed by this action movies, and then like, and that's why, and then with the rise of Avid type editing and everything, you can go really crazy without having much of a way of craft, where you throw a bunch of filters on lens flare. I guess everyone's happy with it. It makes $100 million first weekend. Then go figure.
I think that's why I kind of gave the first Transporter a pass. I think I just kind of threw a whole line of heavily edited action films, and then when the Transporter came out and they shot scenes where you could actually see the action, I was like, wow, this is wonderful, I can actually keep up with this, when in all honesty the Transporter is not really a good film.
I'm happy that someone paid Corey Ewan like good money, you know, for an American movie, since, you know, like for, to make up all those years, you know, tolling about, in Hong Kong, you know, for dimes and nickels. But still, it was a sort of, you could tell that they had to run through a committee, think the shit out of it, over rehearse it. I mean, and like, you know, we're back in Hong Kong, back in the days, you know, like, those guys were pretty much doing it off the cuff, not really doing much in the way of a crazy rehearsal. They would just, like, leave these guys alone. And, like, that's why you end up with a lot of movies, like, a lot of Sammo Hung movies where, you know, a movie's pretty terrible except for, like, the really awesome fight scenes, you know, because these guys aren't really, like, movie directors, they're action directors. You know, but they could just bring that, just like I said, this electricity to the choreography. They really didn't have to, you know, really work at it all that much, just with everyone being, like, you know, top martial artists, or at least being able to fake it enough. I mean, I know Andy Lau isn't a real martial artist, but he knows enough, or he knew enough that he could totally just look like he could kick ass. Mm. You know, yeah, you probably couldn't, so.
You know, it was Corey Ewan, I'm trying to remember the name of the movie, which had one of my favorite action edits of all time. He did this really stylized shot of Jean-Claude Van Damme putting a sneaker on. And I can't remember what that movie was.
Wait, Troy Hark, Knockoff?
That was Knockoff, that's it.
Yeah.
But I remember him. I remember seeing that scene and going, "Wow, he really tried to sell that shoe putting on." But hey, whatever floats your boat. But
that chase is all about poorly constructed footwear. Yeah, that scene, that chase scene. I was like, "Uh-oh, when will Jean-Claude Van Damme's sneaker give out those laces? Any second now." Chekhov's gun. Watch out! Oh no! Oh no!
Well, let's get back to good movies. You finally get this great movie in the can. How hard was it to get something so wonderful distributed, being such a small budget?
Yeah, it was an ordeal. We were a couple years before the Grindhouse thing happened, you know, before Kill Bill. So, you know, it was just sort of like, okay, this is kind of, it's kind of straight, but it's also sort of like a homage and it's sort of a comedy. It really sort of bugged people how to market it or what slot it would fill, because there really wasn't anything like that at the time. This is like 2002, 2003. So people it was just very sort of confusing. We would get these nice, you know, emails or responses, these nice rejection letters, and like you could tell that they'd actually seen the movie. They're like, oh, we think this is, you know, blah blah blah, you know, like they'd be really specific. But then they go, but then they go to the boilerplate and they go, oh, but unfortunately, your film does not meet our requirements at this time. Thank you very much, blah blah blah. And we got like mountains of that. And then in the meantime, you know, Jesus Christ Vampire Hunter gets distribution like that, and I was like, killed me. It was just sort of like we just fell between the stools. But I mean, eventually, the worst top thing was we got a deal with a distributor. I think they're barely hanging on now as it is. But like back in the day, they're one of the bigger independent distributors. And they said, okay, we love the movie. We think it's great. But here's what we're going to do. We want you to recut it. We want you to retitle it. And we want to sell it as a dead teenager movie. And I was like, okay.
Cut.
Yeah. So I was like, fuck you. Fuck you. Fuck
yeah.
You.
Yeah. I remember you sending me some proposed artwork for it. And I was just, oh, man.
Yeah.
It was horrifying. Yeah.
Did they propose a title?
Yeah, I don't think I even thought of a title yet. You know, I mean, but
I know what
like,
you lethally forced last summer.
Probably Cotton Mouth or something like that.
Damn it. Like I said, it was hard to figure out. I mean, like, up until that point, we'd done everything right. You know, you make a movie that's halfway decent that people seem to like. You play the festivals, get a lot of reviews, and it's like, okay, well, this should count for something on some level. You know, but then we just people saying, you know what, you know, we got a deal like that one, which is horrible. Or people like just saying, "Oh, maybe you should go to Troma or something." And actually, the contact of Troma said, "Hey, maybe you don't want to go with us." Then we were just floating around in limbo. I was sending emails to anyone, everyone who would like look at the freaking thing. And until I was looking in the back of, you know, like Videoscope, sending them like I saw an ad for Unearth Films, and then I sent them a blind, you know, query email saying blah blah blah. I mean, one of the best things that happened, at least like, PR-wise, was just getting the nice shout-out from Anticool News. I mean, whether or not they actually have any sort of critical acumen is sort of, okay, up to the debate, but just Anticool News saying, hey, one of the 10 best indies of 2001, hurrah, that was just enough to get an opening at many, many places. So, you know, hooray for Harry Knowles and Massaworm down there in Austin. So that I was able to put that in the subject header saying blah, 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 and then I put together a pretty good a query email. The guy there, the head honcho, Stephen Biro, said, okay, sure, send us a copy. Said, okay, you know, why isn't this out there? I want to put it out. And then, you know, there was some rigmarole. because this was coming right at, as the sort of the market was starting to erode. Yeah, after some like drama, yeah, you know, you're able to get out there right, you know, before everything just imploded, and so it was on all the you know, Tower videos and like Hollywood videos, you know, and all over the place. I was like, you know, thank God, Unearthed Films, you know, really sort of backed me up, stood up and put the film out there, and didn't ask me for any asinine, you know, like re-editing, you know, and actually they sprung for some really nice painted artwork when they could have easily gone for giant floating heads or something, you know. So I was like, hey, I mean, those guys in my book, you know, Stephen Biro, those guys. The stand-up fellas.
Yeah, the cover art is beautiful, you know, and it's right in line with the poster art that you're using and stuff. And didn't you have action figures at one point, too?
Yeah, but this is as goofball promotion. That's one of the things that we, it was a very good part, as part of the promotional push. You know, I think one day, I think we were just sitting around, and then the producer, the production manager, Kent Bai, said, hey, you know what this movie needs? Action figures. I was like, okay, that sounds like a good idea. So Kit bashed like a bargain bin X-Files figures and just like just sanded off the face, did some head surgery with some Xena Warrior Princess figures, you know, just like, got some pull in a bunch of things and actually had a pretty professional looking bunch of action figures. If it was budgetarily possible, we probably would have gone with like full-on action figures and like little blister packs as promotional things, if it was just completely insane. But like, if we had the budget, we certainly would have gone full-on like a old school G.I. Joe, 3 1/4 inch, you know, black, you know, little profile thing, little boxes of guys in action poses. But people really liked it. It was something that, you know, like I think Film Threat caught on to it, you know, and as people was seeing the action figures, it's like, hey, this is a cool, funny thing. You know, let's give it a shot. You know, let's at least give it some consideration.
And on such a modest budget, how was, did Priceline accommodate you when you were gallivanting around Tunisia and England filming?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I rode steerage. Yeah, you know,
how romantic!
Yeah, playing bongos with a bunch of Irishmen. It's great.
Now, the cover art actually leads me to a viewer submitted question, and they actually sound a little perturbed by this. They watched the Lethal Force trailer, and I'm assuming they saw the movie because they swear they never once saw Sean Connery in the film, and wanted to know what the hell happened to Sean Connery. I guess I don't know. Maybe they should set their I guess some people are easily duped, or
I seem to remember there was some. Wasn't there some conflict on the set or something? I remember reading about that.
Oh yeah, there were some salty comments about that whole Leprechaun movie that he made. Darby O'Gillis. I said, Sean, Darby O'Gillis is a piece of shit. Fuck you. He said, you bastard, get out of here! And he ran away. He took his giant red diaper and just said, fuck you. And got on his moped and just drove off out of the rock quarry. And it was a sad day.
I wonder if your distribution woes would have been easier with Sean Connery still on the bill.
There were actual people responded saying, "Hey, is Sean Connery really in your movie?" It's like, "Are you fucking retarded?" No. What the hell? It's Sean Connery, like circa 1974. Are you fucking high? I don't know.
Well, you think the name recognition would clue him in, but then if you notice, the film grain completely changes during that short clip of Sean Connery in the trailer. Oh, yeah. But whatever.
Yeah, so that's it was kind of like the Prism brand like a video cassette from like what, the mid '80s. I was like, holy shit, this is not exactly state of the art transfer here, people. Like whatever. It's like, yeah, I don't know.
Is there any chance of Sean Connery actually showing up in your follow up Kung Fu Opera Blues?
Oh, well, he's like 80 something, isn't he? I mean, he's retired and looks horrible.
CG baby, look what they did for like Leonardo DiCaprio and J. Edgar. I mean, makeup is state of the art. We can do this. We can make him at least look what, 37?
Yeah, well, I guess. I mean, easier just to get some dude who looks like him and then throw a bunch of latex on his face.
Maybe you could buy the computer files of Jeff Bridges from Tron 2 and get him in there.
Oh, yeah, there you go. I think he should be in every movie. CGI, what was that guy's name? Clue?
The
or?
Dude.
The Dude?
Yeah. Dude 0.0.
Whenever someone calls me on my Tron trivia, I'm always embarrassed because I have zero interest and zero knowledge about fucking Tron. Or KG movies, for that matter. So there you go. But let's talk a little bit about Kung Fu Opera Blues, which is supposedly next on your docket. What do you What do you have in mind, Mr. Ikarma?
The point, I think, of any sort of follow-up to the Force is to have it be a bit more slick and a bit more scale, just to say, hey, look, Lethal Force is on purpose. Here's what we can do with actual, you know, with a tripod for once, or, you know, like proper lighting or something. To say, hey, you know what, we're not, like, dark place by accident. You know, we actually sort of thought about this. Lethal Force is intentional, and now here's our slightly slicker, slightly scaled-up, version, or at least like along the same lines, the same vein. I wouldn't want to do it the same thing all over again, and if I did repeat myself, would be sort of lame. I mean, if I'm gonna make something, a follow-up that's gonna fail, okay, let's fail big and fail spectacularly. I'm just gonna go in this direction of just like, okay, let's figure out enough of a budget, enough of a R&D regarding this sort of a production value, and then just have like sort of a for real kind of movie. Or at least as close as we can, and considering the competition, like on this level, is just like an orgy of terrible CG and like awful karate. I think at least I could sort of beat the peers or the micro cinema thing at least on that level.
So the Lethal Force sequel is definitely not in the future, or
if someone said here's a big sack of money, make a Lethal Force sequel, I'd be like, okay, awesome, I'll ditch whatever I was making before and. You know, I'll fuck about with your money in many horrible ways. I had enough of an idea on how to do a sequel or just some kind of follow up. You know, if it's going to be like bootstrap filmmaking, I'll make the movie I want to make. The market is horrible. You can't monetize anything. You can't really sort of say figure out if there's any, I don't know if there's any space left for just like independent films like that. You know, $1.98 kind of movies. So I mean. Just considering where things are now, considering where I am now, life-wise, you know, I'm just gonna like make this thing, or hopefully make this thing, and then just see where the see where things fall, you know, how the cookie crumbles, whatever, and just make the movie, and then and just make it for myself, and just really just follow my own guts as opposed to sort of trying to play any sort of market, trying to be overly marketable or overly trying to sort of be commercial. I'll just make the movie that I want to make. You know, and we'll see if anyone wants to see the movie that I want to make.
Well, you know, Mike is a media mogul, and with his own magazine and his podcast, and he's a huge fan of Lethal Force. I think if you sweet talk, maybe blow in his ear a little bit, maybe he'll fund your next big budget film.
Okay, Mike, that's right. Let me tell you, I'm bringing out the knee pads, buddy boy.
I've got that $1.98 for you.
Awesome.
There is one question I do have about Lethal Force. The big flashback that we have with Savage and Prather towards the end, where we finally see, you know, their times together, the soldier bits and the stuff like that. What the hell movie were those massacre scenes taken from?
I think it's pretty obvious.
Mission Force.
I fucked with the image enough that I can say that it was an original thing.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay. My curiosity is satisfied. This goes no further.
Yeah. Well, but you know, pretty sure. I mean, look. If for the record, let's just say it's all Fantasy Mission Force, because I know that's public domain at this point. How that works exactly? Because I know that that's had that official release, but I know people are still like bootlegging the Beyond and everything. So it's like, okay. Yeah. Well, I guess sort of the vague area depends if they want to sue you or not. But in any case, it's all Fantasy Mission Force. So,
and in any case, it's just a few seconds of it. I think fair use might have you covered.
And on that note, let's take a little break.
Drop your weapon!
Don't you move!
When I get out, you ain't gonna make it.
Where you going?
Nobody gets out.
Vengeance is mine. Can I get an amen?
Amen.
Deep in Texas.
What's this?
The law has been broken.
This is the beginning of all of it.
I'm gonna tell you what I'm gonna do to you.
The police are killers.
She had to know something.
You listen. You don't want to go there.
And the truth is buried.
We're talking about a decorated policeman.
Need you to testify.
Are you crazy? Who could have testified?
Now, we need to talk.
Now, what I have to say needs to be said in person.
You coon hunting.
Between one man's past.
Why?
child are dead because I didn't know when to quit.
And one woman's future.
Where'd you get those?
And the nice policeman over there.
Lies the fate of a city. In the grasp of...
You think that we came up with this? It's a lot bigger than Holland.
Silent justice.
I don't really think you have any choice.
Don't even think about it!
He's got her! He took her!
I promise, and I'm a promise keeper! Nobody's walking away from here!
The trigger. Don't you get it? It's a revolution.
Richard Tyson.
Guilty!
Silent Justice.
And we're back. First and foremost, I want to thank our very special guest, writer and director, Sir Alvin E. Karma. We thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And I would also like to thank the most distinguished gentleman, Mr. Mike White. Check out all of Mike's projects at impossiblefunky.com. You have a new book coming out, don't you, Mike?
Eventually, as soon as my proofreader gets through with it. So she won't be listening to this, so I can talk bad about her. But yeah, one of these days.
Well, until then, catch up on Cashiers to Cinema. I got actually the little anthology of the best of, and it's wonderful. In this podcast, All Bullshit Aside is one of my favorites. It's a wonderful podcast. He's a wonderful guy and a great kisser. Aww. And finally, I'd like to thank my esteemed colleague, Dr. Freaks. Freeman, you're a gentleman and a scholar, sir.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure as always. Love meeting you two guys.
It's great talking to you. I'm currently bootlegging for evil right now, so Force of Evil right now.
Forever Evil.
Sorry, I've got Lethal Force and Forever Evil mixed up. So
yeah, you can bootleg Force of Evil all you want. Yeah, well, you know, I don't get any money out of it, so hell, go right ahead.
And I am Joe, a.k.a. The Creeper from Daily Grindhouse, not advocating bootlegging any film. Thank you for tuning in. Buy Lethal Force, buy it today. Hell, buy Forever Evil. Buy whatever you like. Help the economy. Buy, Mike, what should they buy?
I think Force of Evil would be good.
Yeah. Buy Force of Evil. Buy I Know What You Lethally Forced Last Summer.
Buy Jet Benny also.
Buy Jet Benny. Buy Young Lady Shatterly 2. Buy Rats Are Coming, The Werewolves Are Here. Bye, bye, bye. And goodbye.
Right. Bye.
Bye. Okay. Pooping, but so. Oh.